I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about cartoon artists, those cartoons they're using to try to get us to laugh. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. There's no mystery about this. My guest, Bob Mankoff, has been doing lots of shows since the publication of his cartoon illustrated memoir, but I don't care if he has done 1,000 shows. I love what he does as a cartoonist and as cartoon editor of The New Yorker. Where else would they run a picture of a dog in a business suit at the local bar and the bartender says scotch and toilet water? I can't wait to talk with Bob, and you can too, at 203-776-9677. His memoir is one terrific read, hilarious, brilliantly illustrated with original and published cartoons from the magazines. A star-studded Academy of Wits, including Roz Chast, who lives in our broadcast region and was our guest. Bob Mankoff, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Faith, for that rousing introduction. I hope I can live up to it.
I bet you can.
This is only my 999th interview, so I still have one to go, but I think this is going to be a delightful one.
Hey, so what has that been like, being on the road, doing these all over the place? Well, what is it like for you?
I don't know. It's just, I guess it's like what Willie Nelson feels like. without the dope.
So have people said, you know, we love absurdity? You know, that's part of the reason that we turn to the magazines, cartoons. So have people said, I mean, as they do sometimes, just the most absurd things? I love collecting these from authors.
Pretty much they, what they do is, if I'm at a book event, they have cartoons that they have been harboring for many years.
Yeah, me too.
And that's right. So that's why I'm happy to, that this is done over the phone.
Not me.
No. So yeah, but I'll come out, of course, and I do. The surprising things would be because there was an episode or there was a segment on 60 Minutes about me, the New Yorker cartoonist, the book, and everything. So initially, when some attractive woman would look at me at an airport, I would think, oh, I'm not so old after all. But then I realized she saw me on 60 Minutes.
where did I meet you, she's thinking.
Yeah. So, it's been interesting. I do like to, to some extent, you say some of the same things and some of the same jokes. But as I got into it more and more, I just like to have conversations with people about the New Yorker magazine, about the cartoons, and I find that if you have a real conversation with them, they also are likely to maybe go off script and maybe ask a question different from what they had intended.
Yeah, so you've made me think about what cartoon from, I've had so many up over the years from the New Yorker has been on my wall, and I remember taking one. It's not up there right now since we moved to our studio, but I had one up there for years of, you were eye level with the upper floors of a skyscraper.
Yeah.
And there was, it was at the corner of the building. And so on one side, there was someone edging toward the corner. On the other side from a window, there was someone edging toward the,
the corner. So they're out on the ledge. And I think it's a Tom Chaney cartoon where it looks like they're going to, something like it. You two should meet each other, right?
Yeah, there's somebody I'd like you to meet.
Absolutely.
So that gets me to absurdity. I think about this. I think there are some people who are so who get absurdity to such a degree, and other people who just don't have that button, you know?
Well, I mean, there are degrees of absurdity in what I talk about in the book, incongruity. So there's certain about that, but that's not completely absurd, right? I mean, what it does is it takes what in normal life would be a terrifying situation, right? It looks like two people want to kill themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And they're saying, well, you actually have a lot in common. Maybe. So there's actually something a little bit philosophical about it. It's not totally, absolutely weird. I'm thinking of, let's say, a cartoon I did a long time ago. And one of the things, real absurdity, real incongruity tends to be done by younger people. And the truth is, it tends to be liked by younger people. To some extent, the whole developmental thing of humor is, as in many things, we tend to get more conservative as we get older. Not you. Not me, but them. Okay. just so we know who we're talking, who we're pointing this finger at. So I did a cartoon once where I have my database here. Let me see.
Is this the Shut Up Bob cartoon?
What's that?
The Shut Up Bob? Or is that what the...
No.
Because...
Well, Shut Up Bob, everybody knows your parrot's a clip-on. That was from the caption contest, right?
Yeah.
Where the parrot's on everybody's shoulder. And that's sort of weird, because, okay, there's another cartoon that was also in that contest, okay, just to describe for the listeners. Everybody is at a boardroom table, all men, and they all have parrots on their shoulder, except actually the boss. And so one of the answers was, we've got to think of a better way to record our meetings. And that's sort of a straight joke, because, right, we understand parrots repeat things.
Yeah.
So in the ridiculous logic world of humor, which is based on ridiculous logic, but still logic nevertheless, you know, that makes sense. The caption that actually won was, "Shut up, Bob, everybody knows your parrot's a clip-on," which is weird because all of a sudden a whole new idea about parrots is being created.
Yeah, I love that somebody did that. The other one that I couldn't believe this was so clever is there was a person in bed and the wall, the headboard to the bed, every square inch is written with things like cancer.
Right, isn't it? I like to write down little things like when I can't sleep. Now, but though, that is not...
Well, wait. We have to say what it is. When I can't sleep, I find that it sometimes helps to get up and jot down my anxieties. There are about 5,000 words.
Right. And so that's very funny, I think, but I think it's sort of, true. I mean, it's making a joke of it. It's different than, straight absurdity. I'll give you an example. This is a cartoon I did in 1979. Shows a guy with various things on a table in front of him. And he's saying, and these are the things, all you need is a bicycle pump, or an ordinary deck of playing cards, and a pair of deerskin slippers, and you're ready to begin. Okay, ready to begin what? You know what I mean? So there's no, in other words, there's no closure in that at all. You know, that is just, to me, like a humor tone poem. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You just pick the elements. And the interesting thing about that is people who are open to that type of humor, see, I already know you're probably even from NPR, I would know it, but people who like that, I don't mean like that to the exclusion of other jokes, people who like that versus people who say, what? That's ridiculous. That doesn't make any sense at all, tend to be more liberal. More liberal politically. They tend to like art that's a little bit more adventurous, music. You know, they're more open to new things and new experience. In other words, they don't need everything sort of tied up in a little bow where you always have to get it. And a lot of great cartoons, of course, there is this complete get-it factor, like in a Michael Crawford cartoon where it's called French Army Knife and it has all corkscrews. Everybody understands that, and it's still a great cartoon. So it's not so much that one is better than the other, but the preferences sort of show you a little bit what preferences elsewhere in life are, and that's what I think is interesting about actually analyzing it.
I have this, you say when I die and then I come back again, this is what I'm going to be, and decades I've said a New Yorker cartoonist, and you know, then
I'm going to come back again as mulch.
Then I remind myself that I can't draw, and I think, well, what could I do? And I think about different ways to get around that. And so this brings me to, you know, your pointillism, you know, making all those little dots to create the graphic of the cartoon itself that you do, that I know is so time consuming and so amazing as a style.
On the other hand, there are secret messages there that the NSA is using to communicate with its operatives overseas.
It's not a bad idea.
I mean, this is something I did not reveal in the book, but now that the whole Snowden thing has come out, I feel...
See what happens when we relax?
See, that is just even a little bit. Okay.
So,
I never said that before in any interview.
Bruce Eric... Bruce Eric Kaplan has that unusual. This is hard for me to explain. If you're, you know, I follow New Yorker cartoons like crazy, like baseball teams, and so Bruce Eric Kaplan does these people, these figures. I don't even know how would I even explain.
Well, I mean, it's stark. It's all done in strong blacks and white. It's stylistically, it's almost like a retro style. It almost has it almost has an Art Deco feel to it. Mm-hmm. It's always in a box. All the figures are black and white. The captions are often it's the same types of figures. The best way to find out is go up on the cartoonbank.com and look at Bruce Eric Kaplan as you're listening to this radio, and you will know exactly. And Bruce is like a master of fantastic, captions, you know, and he really minds, you know. One of the things I talk about in the book is how our humor is directed back to the class that's reading it. It's not humor that's, you know, speaking truth to power. We know how effective that is. or down towards perceived inferiors. But Bruce does cartoons, you know, where in a way there's a whole sort of inverted universe where it's not completely unlike some of Charles Adams in that everything is flipped on its side. So you see what appears to be, you know, loving mothers and their kids are playing, and one mother is saying to the other, "They grow up so slow." So just to change your one word from fast to slow. And one of the things that shows is that humor is always about things that in real life are not good. It can never elevate. It can never cheerlead. You know, it can never be, you know, for something. It basically is a deflator and what Steven Pinker called, I think, a digicide, you know, in terms of deflating our dignity.
Mm. You know, for this Bruce Eric Kaplan, I always think to myself that his figures seem these remote suburban people, and they always seem to me very disconnected from their feelings. So the caption, there's a man and a woman in the living room,
right.
And the caption is, "Of course I care about how you imagined, I thought you perceived, I wanted you to feel."
It's one of my favorite ones, and believe me, that is a hard caption to remember. but it's wonderfully insightful.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it does show in a very gentle way, benign way, friendly way of the gulf. The gulf, the easiest gulf to portray is the gulf between men and women. But in a broader way, that's the gulf between, you know, everyone. I think I did a cartoon. I did do a cartoon once, and I think the guy is saying to the woman who he's dating, "Maureen, I can't change. The most I can do is pretend to change." And women don't understand how hard that even is.
Yeah. Oh. All right. Stay just where you are, Bob. But Bob Mankoff, who's New Yorker cartoon editor, and we're going to continue our conversation with him. There's a story I want to tell him about Gene Wilder and Gilda Radner and see what your reaction is. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. My guest, Bob Mankoff. I've been waiting and waiting for this conversation. He's cartoonist, cartoon editor of The New Yorker magazine. His illustrated memoir is called How About Never? Is Never Good for You? One of the greatest lines ever on a cartoon in the history of cartoons, if you ask me. I mean, it rocketed through our society so fast. Here's the thing. I was talking with Gene Wilder in this studio at one point, and he was talking about that he had met someone new after Gilda Radner died.
Yeah,
and he said, I didn't he said, I so loved Gilda. I was very much in love with her. He said, I didn't know, I don't think what real love was until I met my second wife. And I said, well, why do you say that? He said, because I don't feel pressure to be funny around her. He said, I didn't realize it, but I think I felt like I had to be on my toes with Gilda. I felt like I needed to be funny. How does that work for you, Bob? I mean, you're just naturally a funny guy, but do you feel pressure because you're the cartoon editor that people have an expectation of you to be funny?
Well, I hadn't felt pressure up until now.
Stick with me.
Well, let's see. I've been married 3 times. It just keeps getting better and better. I'm presently married to the wonderful Corey Scott Whittier, who, when I get to be too funny, she says, is that professional humor?
Oh, she sounds great.
So she brings me back to earth because sometimes she just knows I can just go off and start doing bits and stuff. But yeah. I will say this, all the women I've been married to, I have made each one of them laugh so much that they wet their pants.
Okay, well, that's saying
something. And I consider that one of my great accomplishments.
Yeah.
And I don't write about that in the book, but, you know, I'll do it on a blog, just what the technique is. And that
there's a technique?
Oh, well, yeah, you got to go in for the kill at a certain point. Just when they think that you've let up.
Ah.
That's when they're most vulnerable.
Oh, but that is good. That is so good. Did you just, you know, you must have gotten dates with just anyone you wanted, since you know that strategy. I mean, think about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
But
or second dates, I should say.
Second date. Well, I think humor is a good way to connect with people. And certainly, you know, in terms of relationships, it's one of the things that people think is most important. And it is. Doesn't mean that both people have to be funny in the same way. But I think in the end, you know, there's a lot life deals a lot of difficult things. That's just the nature of life. And one of the functions of humor is to cope. And if you have that in your arsenal and something, and you can, you know, make yourself laugh and make other laughs, you know, I'm grateful for it. I like to do it. I mean, I like to do it. I don't do it all the time. And, you know, I do like to leave no joke unjoked. If I see the opportunity, you know, I don't like to go away from a situation. I don't feel pressure. I don't like to go away from a situation saying, I wish I had said that, you know, because I'm worried that, oh, maybe somebody would offend it or maybe somebody didn't get it. And I think people should indulge their sense of humor a little bit more. Most people are very, very inhibited about even, you know, trying to sort of lighten the load by just, you know, being funny, kidding around a little bit. I strongly advise it, you know. Sometimes I was saying to someone the other day, I go into a Starbucks and they ask me my name. I say, Steve, but that's not my real name. Is that okay? And just do that. See what the reaction is. Maybe some people will look at you blankly. Other people will laugh. And all of a sudden, you've sort of created this bond. You know what I mean? That it's like you said that, you know what? Life is a little absurd. Starbucks is absurd. Nothing wrong with it, but everyone having a name, you know. You could be, I think I first did this when I was the only, I may not even have been Starbucks. I was in Seattle. I was the only person in the coffee shop. And I said, I'm the only one here. Why do you have to know my name? So I think you know, and then here's a joke I didn't make and I regretted making. Okay, I had an appointment and I had some time, and my wife is always after me for, like many wives, perhaps for my toenails, which are, you know, they grow too long, grotesque, they look sort of Godzilla-like. And she says, would you please go get a pedicure? And, you know, guys are not that hot about getting pedicures. But anyway, I had some time, and, you know, so the endless nail salons everywhere. And I said, okay, you know, I'm going to go get a pedicure. So I go in. Of course, you go in, and you have to announce you're a real guy, saying, hey, this is the first time I've ever had one, you know, just to show you're a real man. So I do that, and I start getting a pedicure, and it's very elaborate. And then a guy comes in with his wife and daughter. His wife wasn't getting one, but a little girl, maybe 7 or 8, was getting one. And so they're both getting the pedicures, and the little girl says, hey, Daddy, how come you're not getting your nails colored like me? And so the guy says, well, men haven't really started doing that, and I don't want to be the first. So, okay, that's a little joke. And what I should have said, what I wanted to say to him, what I regretted saying was, hey, I'm going to get mine done. You'll be second. But I didn't say it. You know what I mean? And so I regret that, because just to have that type of fun with that situation was interesting.
Yeah. I was in a corporate meeting space, and there were about 1,000 people. I mean, you could not hear yourself think. And so people were screaming at each other. There was something about this that I found so absurd. And so I'm in this sort of circle, and someone, you know, we were trying to have an exchange, and I, just for some reason, I shouted at the person, "You say you're a communist?" And, you know, this look of horror came over this person's face. And then it absolutely made me wild with laughter. I mean, it was just... So how about this? When you collaborate with the cartoonist bringing in, I mean, maybe Roz Jess is listening right now and she's saying, collaborate. When you do, are you judging based on what you personally think is funny or what you know other people will find funnier than you do, you know?
I think it's a combination of those two things. You know, certainly my sensibility and David Remnick's sensibility, who makes ultimate judgments on these things, are definitely involved. Mm-hmm. You know, and I have, I would call an aesthetic involved with cartoons in that, you know, I have a general overall philosophy, a little bit about ideas about humor, but also ideas of what's valuable and what's right for the New Yorker. So something people might find actually incredibly funny or offensive and everything, but that's not right. I know that's not right for New York. A lot of people will be offended, and it's not worth it because it's not that great a joke. If it was a great joke, it'd be okay for them to be somewhat offended.
Yeah.
And the annals of the offended are very long and elaborate, but for almost any reason. But the other thing I decide is, is something else being said besides the joke? Because if we can't just be silly, you know. So in the Bruce Eric Catholic thing, that's very much about perception and psychology. There's a whole statement there. In Charlie Barsatti's cartoons with the pilgrims searching for truth, you know, a pilgrim on, you know, there's a sign that says truth, but the pilgrim is usually walking towards it, but he's on a treadmill. That's saying things. Charlie Barsatti, where there's a dog psychiatrist talking to the dog patient on the couch, and the dog patient is saying, "They moved my bowl." You know, that. So these things are funny and they're good, but they also say something. So those have this value added. Of course, then I'm thinking about the artists themselves. You know, in the book I say, you know, play favorites, but don't play so much that no one else gets to play. People want to see Roz Chass cartoons. They've come to know her.
Yeah.
There's a whole aura and penumbra about her cartoons that enhance the cartoons. So, you know, these are editorial and aesthetic decisions, but it is a combination because I do know this a lot from doing talks and presentations. I know what people actually think is funny, and often that coincides with what I think is funny, but often what people will really find funny is also, you know, very, very corny, and I'll say that's too corny for the New Yorker. I actually know people will find it's funny, but in the New Yorker, we push the envelope a little bit that way. We certainly care what our audience thinks about, but not so much that we can't push the audience a little bit to where we think they should be.
How political could you get? For instance, could you have a cartoon that's sort of made fun of a particular Supreme Court justice?
Yeah, you could definitely make fun. I mean, in a way, I did that, I guess, in a very oblique way, because I played off of the famous Karl Rose cartoon where, you know, the mother is saying to the little girl, "Eat your broccoli." And a little girl, this is from 1928, and a little girl is saying, "I say it's spinach and the hell with it."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then I did a cartoon in 2012, where the mother, it's implicit that she says eat the broccoli because we know that joke, and the little boy is saying, "I say it's government-mandated broccoli," and I say the hell with it, because that's what Scalia said. So, you know, in a way, you're making, but it's more, you're more directed, you know. So certainly we satirize George Bush, we satirize even Obama, you know, and we're making fun, but not in a way like drawing a funny mustache on the Mona Lisa.
Right. This is Bob Mankoff, and his cartoon illustrated memoir is called "How About Never Is Never Good for You." He's cartoonist and cartoon editor at the New Yorker magazine. It was Tina Brown who, when she was editor, who had the idea to start the Cartoon Bank for Ordinary Citizens.
No, that or was is totally it? Wrong.
Okay.
No, this we
I
have,
thought I read that in your memoir.
No. I mean, Tina, okay, this now we have to say, Tina was great. Tina, I owe everything to you, Tina, but I can't pay you back. But I started the Cartoon Bank in 1991.
Oh, with I all apologize. The cartoons,
with all the cartoons in New Yorker rejected, okay? And, you know, that became, you know, an actual business. Now, Tina became, you know, editor around that time, 91, 92. And then Tina and other people eventually wanted to buy the Cartoon Bank from me, which they did. I mean, the New Yorker, Cy Newhouse, bought it from me, but for Tina's urging.
Yeah.
Because Tina thought it was a great idea. And they did that, and I became president of the Cartoon Bank, and I did for the New Yorker what I had done for the rejects. I scanned all the New Yorker cartoons. That's what the Cartoon Bank is. In addition to it, has rejected cartoons. So Tina was certainly the impetus, but I created it well before, and Tina wouldn't deny that. It wasn't her idea, but and then I ran it as president until 2008. And then shortly after I became president of the Cartoon Bank for the New Yorker, Lee Lorenz retired, and I became cartoon editor as well.
So what was the reaction of the cartoonists initially? I remember once a cartoonist for the magazine said to me, you know, it could be considered a little bit insulting to us, as if you could go into tell ordinary citizens to start fixing cars in professional garages. You know, this.
You're talking about the Cartoon Bank or the caption contest?
I'm talking about the caption contest. That's why we're having this.
That's
okay.
Why we're having it. Yes, the caption.
Sorry,
contest.
I should have called it the right thing.
I can understand that, but the truth is that the cartoonist does the heavy lifting on that, and the proof is in the pudding.
Well, for me, it makes me understand, because I've you know, done it so many times, it makes me understand how hard it is to do this. If anything, it has made me appreciate that, because it's
a
mystery
to
us.
A million people are looking at it, and 5 to 10,000 get an idea. You know, this would be, I mean, this is what the internet shows us in general about crowdsourcing. You know, so yes, show it to a million people, something that the cartoonist has created, and 5 and 10,000 people come up, or 10,000 people come over, will you get a good caption? Sometimes easily as good as the cartoonist for that one time? Absolutely. It would be the same thing. Let's say there's Ken Jennings, right, who was the Jeopardy champion, you know, won all the time.
Yep.
Imagine Ken Jennings, okay, he's over here on the podium, and there's the Jeopardy board, and there's 1 million other people out there who can also press the button. You know what? Someone's going to beat Ken Jennings.
Yeah.
See, so that's what it's like. So it's for that single thing, if you crowdsource it, yeah, you'll do that. But it's the cartoonist who creates the picture. And because you win the caption contest, you can come up with a good caption. That's a very different thing than making a whole drawing and doing 10 or 20, you know, every week. But it also does show you that the ability to be funny is very widely distributed in the population, and it's not only confined to the professionals who do it.
I can't believe how good people are sometimes. You know, I used to get notes because I would enter it saying, Faith Middleton, don't stop trying, which was nice, but it also made me feel pitied.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have... I don't have it right on my computer now, but I have a database of all 2 2,250,000 entries. So I will look up.
No!
I won't do it.
I will
right
be
now.
Mortified.
I won't, but I will. But I will. I'll. When your producer will send me your email, and I will give you a PDF of all your entries or all the images.
Oh my goodness! Okay.
Okay.
So you are, to me, enlightening in this book on the subject of what makes something funny, which is a dangerous subject. This
Very
is,
dangerous.
You know, yeah, it's like trying to explain what laughter is.
That
so,
can be done too.
Yeah. Well, let's hear. Let's get into this a little bit. And,
yeah.
And by the way, Bob, as we do, let me say, if you would like to jump in and speak to the cartoon editor of The New Yorker, when do you get a chance to do this? 203-776-9677. Ask a question, make a comment. 203-776-WNPR is the easy way to remember. Okay, Bob, now, how do we set what the rules are to make something funny?
Well, I think the basic foundation of all humor is surprise. Surprise is, you know, to get all wonky about it. Surprise is always bad. Initially, we should always think it's bad because, from an evolutionary sense, something bad could happen. We always want to predict what's going to happen. So you will see in Peekaboo and how children react and how, in a startle, anytime you're startled where you think something bad is going to happen and all of a sudden it turned out to be nothing, you will laugh. Mm-hmm. You know, it's called relief humor. I think all humor is sort of based on that, and then you overlay that with all this, you know, cognitive tricks, jokes. That's not comedy. But if you will listen to people, if you just watch what happens, laughter is an emotional regulation mechanism. Laughter is breathing, okay? Breathing, in fact, it's always on the exhale. When we really laugh hard, all of our oxygen gets in that, and then we breathe in, right? So any little thing that goes wrong, watch someone just, you be the anthropologist, watch someone around the office and see how often they laugh. Just any little mishap, any little thing, and little mishaps, getting off on the wrong floor, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Making some little mistake, well, that's always a surprise. So the initial surprise is, ooh, something wrong happened, and then nothing happened. So just that itself, it's really important. It's called sort of the false alarm mechanism. Okay? And then laughter is loud. It signals, basically. One of the reasons is that you very rarely do you laugh by yourself. I mean, you'll laugh if you imagine something that's pseudo-social, but laughter is almost social. So then you know a lot about laughter. You know a lot about humor. You know what the basic mechanism. It's social. It communicates these things. On top of that, eventually you have, it's play. Okay? We play. And one of the things human beings continue to do, all animals play. And we stop playing fairly early, but we continue to play constantly. And how do we play? We play with language. And so we move from seriousness to playfulness constantly. So all of that is sort of the foundation from which you then make jokes. So jokes are, you know, jokes traditionally in the book, I talk about a setup and a punchline. So I'm 70. Now I'm going to tell you two little jokes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You'll see how it works. So, you know, I'm 70. The good news is 70 is the new 50. The bad news is dead isn't the new alive. Okay. I'm 70. The good news is it could be worse. The bad news is it will be.
Yeah.
So there it is. You see, I've set it up. Partly each time you're surprised, there's one narrative going one way and the other way. So humor works like that. That's not the art of humor. That's just the structure of it. That doesn't tell you, I mean, I talk about that in the book, but that doesn't tell you really any more how to make jokes than to say, oh, by the way, music is based on tone, timbre, rhythm, and dynamics. It's all true, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then the art of it comes from our experience. But I do understand these things, and so one of the ways to look at different types of humor is, okay, sometimes you have completely cerebral humor, so the whole thing about it, right, is a little cognitive thrill. So when we put the things together, like the French Army knife, where it's all corkscrews, there's a little delight, right? You understand it.
Yeah.
Then there's transgressive humor. We don't have that, really, in The New Yorker, where most of the jolt is because we're saying things we shouldn't. And we're releasing, you know, those impulses. And there's even empathetic humor. You know, like when the Barsotti cartoon where they move my bowl, we empathize with that little dog. We understand that the whole human condition, all the bitching and the whining, all the things we think are so important are because somebody moved our bowl.
Yeah, change. Yeah, it's all about the change. Okay, again, please stay where you are because we're going to return in after this very short break to continue our conversation with Bob Mankoff, cartoonist and cartoon editor of The New Yorker magazine. We'll be right back. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR or join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening. And to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. We are in conversation with Bob Mankoff. He's a cartoonist, cartoon editor at The New Yorker magazine, and his cartoon illustrated memoir is it is the best read, honestly. And also, talk about humor being social. I sat by myself and laughed so many times looking at these. So his memoir is called How About Never Is Never Good For You, a line from one of his own cartoons that was set such a standard in cartooning, I think. I know from reading your book that you tried and wanted so much to get your cartoons
right
into The New Yorker. And it took, as it does for everybody, it took a long, long time, didn't it?
It did. It took me from 1974 till 1977, so for 3 years. And I was publishing cartoons elsewhere. And people are in that same boat now. I mean, we haven't bought one yet, but I keep saying, you know, keep trying. And yeah, so it's you have to be persistent, but you also have to try to improve. Just can't be dysfunctionally persistent.
Now, do you say that to be kind to everyone? You know, keep trying,
yeah.
Or do you?
Oh no, not to everyone.
Some
people I tell to stop. Although I have a hard time doing that. I mean, I got a wise guy, Queens, you know, New York, Jewish aspect to me, and I can seem, you know, a little sharp sometimes. But I feel bad for people when, you know, they try so hard and they, I know they really want to and they're trying as hard as they can, but it's just not working. And so I do tell people that, you know, it's just not working. And I try to tell them also that, hey, this is just, really, it really just is my opinion and our opinion, you know? It could be wrong. Maybe you're going to be enormously successful elsewhere. But at a certain point, you know, I don't want it to be, can become an obsession with someone, you know? And I want to free them from that obsession.
Well, there is this, I certainly have heard many a spouse say that the writing partner will not rest until you get a letter of acceptance from The New Yorker, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so I'm sure that for people who are trying cartoons, we know, where do you go to school to study the art of cartooning?
Well, you know, when I give talks at high school sometimes, or even younger, I ask if anybody wants to be a cartoonist. And sometimes I say, well, that's great. If you do, you can quit school right now. So that's not that popular.
I was just going to say.
At high school. And that's when they escort me out of the high school.
I was going to say.
And it was only a joke. It's just go one more year.
Bada boom. It's like
for insurance. But I think most cartoonists are self-taught. And, you know, it's life's lessons. And you have to have a mind for that. We have a new cartoonist this last couple of years at New York. His name is Ed Steed. Originally, he was from England. He's an architect. He's 25 years old. He's actually visiting. And he was living in Taipei so that he could afford the cartoon. And let's see, Ed, what was Ed's background? I don't know. He was from England. He just told me that at one point he herded sheep.
I've got to look at this stuff.
Yeah, you have to look at this stuff. And he draws adorable little sheep. And the he's an unusual guy and everything, and so they come in all shapes and sizes, as does talent from every field. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I can't say what makes someone funny. There are so many different ways to be funny, and so many different experiences, and a certain congenial temperament to, like you said, a way of looking at the world and appreciating its absurdity. But anyway, one of the things that Ed said to me, because he was visiting, he's actually staying here in Queens for 3 months, he said, and I said, well, what? Because he hadn't really published elsewhere, and he was an architect, and he stopped doing that. He said, well, he picked up the New Yorker magazine, and he looked at it, and he'd had some, you know, background training. He said to himself, I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that one of the things is you do need, you know, one of the things I would say to people who are aspiring to this is, you know, ratchet down the awe of the New Yorker magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? If you're in too awe, that's, I liked what he said, partly because he didn't really know much about the New Yorker magazine, you know, and he said, you know, I can do that. And that's really how I felt, too.
Yeah,
when I looked at it, I felt, I can do that. My mind works that way. And so, you know, I think those are the requirements. I don't think you have, you know, arrogance or... But you need to think you can do it.
Mm-hmm. 203-776-9677 to talk to Bob Mankoff. 203-776-WNPR. So... how do you get to everybody's freelance? There were just a few people who would have contracts at the New Yorker.
No, quite a few have contracts.
Well, so you talk in the book about that it was quite difficult to land a contract.
Yeah, it is.
At the New Yorker.
And it still is, because, you know, you have to feel more money is paid, and it was very, very, it was difficult. You had a show that I showed the letters, you know, from Lee Lorenz to William Shawn and stuff like that, that we, you know, one of the things I say is that we're not looking for cartoons, we're looking for cartoonists. So we will publish people, and we have to see that over the years they're going to develop a style that also has a personality.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't just, and we want jokes, of course, but so whether it's Roz Chast or me or Bruce Eric Kaplan or Jack Ziegler or Charles Barsotti, there's a whole personality that is revealed through the cartoons. They don't seem like one-ofs, you know what I mean, one after the other, just sort of these random jokes. So it is difficult, but we still do give them out.
So staying, it has to be somebody with staying power.
Right, staying power and personality.
So this brings me back to you, because here you do this sort of pointillist style,
yeah.
These little, which takes forever, and I think, oh, now you're locked in.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's my pointillist bed, and I have to lie on it. So I mean, once I tried to like attach a pen to a electric toothbrush to make the points faster, but that didn't work out.
The electrified Jackson Pollock.
Right. Yeah. But as I say in the book, it was a type of meditation, a type of thinking, and I still like it. I'm an antsy guy, and so it mm-hmm. keeps me at the drawing board, you know, while away the hours. You need the wool gathering, you need the, you know, the drawing, the thinking, and just the staring off into space, hoping an idea will wend its way towards your brain.
Yeah. So I was watching myself at one point when I found something particularly funny, and all of a sudden I thought, wait a minute, look what I just did. And it was the way my eye was moving. So I had glanced for a fraction of a second at the drawing,
uh-huh.
and then to the line, and then back to the drawing, and on that second return to the drawing is when I burst out laughing.
Yeah, it was probably because there was something in the drawing that you noticed. Might be a drawing like, you know, Tom Chaney's, the caption is, we've child-proofed our home, and it just looks like an ordinary house, and a couple is talking to another couple, but then you see outside in the window the children have their faces pressed up and are clearly locked out of the house.
So, do you know, I mean, do they get into the metrics of this to such a degree that you know how the eye works? I mean, and
I did some experiments at the University of Michigan, and yeah, I mean, we did that. We don't keep doing that, but I did that independently. But when the eye I mean, I think what does happen is, though, is that you see the image first, you take that in, and if there's nothing incongruous in the image, if it's just sort of, you know, a guy on a phone, like, you know, no Thursdays at Al Bundy and everything, you'll just go right to the caption. You're not going to investigate the image more. But in that other drawing I described, you're actually going to quickly look at the image, look at the caption, and like you said, look back to find that incongruous element that makes sense of it. At the moment that you do find the element, when we do the eye tracking, the pupil expands. That's sort of the moment then you get it, which is sort of interesting because that's what the pupil does. It's sort of an attention and orienting response. So we don't do that. We don't evaluate the cartoons that way. That was just an experiment that I did at the University of Michigan, which was, sort of interesting.
Did they ask you to?
Did the New Yorker ask me to?
No, did the university ask you?
Oh, I was teaching out there, and it was my idea along with this guy, Rick Lewis, who had this eye-tracking equipment that he had used for, that usually is used for reading comprehension, to see that when people read and scan lines, where their eyes go and what's the most efficient way for, you know, putting text on paper.
Yeah. So I just wanted to tell you that I loved the cartoon you did when you said the husband and wife talking. She's on the couch with her arms folded as they should be. And he's got his hands in his pocket. And he's, you know, with some assurance saying to her, "Believe me, Janet, I consider you an important part of our marriage." It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you do take the things to their absurd conclusion. I do have a lot of cartoons sort of like that. One of them, a woman is saying to the husband, "I wasn't listening here. Could you repeat what you said since we've been married?"
Oh, that's so good. Oh, boy, is that good. Now, is it Hamilton, right, who does the rich people?
Yeah, the rich people, right.
Oh, boy. Those are always guaranteed to amuse me. Remember the one where they're all sitting around the dinner party in their tuxedos and whatnot, and somebody's saying money is life's report card?
Yeah, very deep. And, another one of his I really love is the couple is leaving another couple's house, and the woman is saying, "Oh, yes, we know them. We hate them." I thought that always makes me laugh just saying, I just love it. So simple. We know them. We hate them. But we understand that we know them and we hate them. And that's so interesting because it wasn't like they've just met these people once. It means that somehow, even within the social circle, it's still together. You still see the people. You hate the people, but... You know, you're not firing shots and everything except these verbal shots.
So this gets me to, that seems like such a New York joke to me.
It's a sophisticated joke. I mean, it's an urban joke.
Yeah.
I think, it's an urban joke. It's an upper middle class. I don't know how rich, maybe it is. And it is. But I think most people... You know what? You're right.
No, I don't mean that as a criticism.
Right.
I just, so interesting. I never thought about the regionalism, you know, the thing you have to watch out for, you know?
Well, it is. But, you know, the New Yorker actually is all over the country. There are more people who subscribe to it in California than New York. And it's an all pretty, you know, it's a million people who read it. It's not, and so it's certainly not confined to New York. And it's not primarily a magazine about New York. It has goings on about town and stuff like that, but most of the, practically all the articles or even the talk pieces and certainly the cartoons, they refer to New York. And you know what? New York's the biggest city in the United States.
Oh, my. So who did the one where there's two snakes and you're supposed to pick the funniest caption?
Oh, that's Danny Shanahan.
Yeah.
Where one of the snakes has human buttocks.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the one. One of the captions was, "I don't like the way Adam looks at you."
I know. That's good. Oh, well, God, I got to run. I'm having too good a time with you,
okay.
As expected. Thank you, my friend. Wonderful
right.
book. So, so good. I highly recommend it.
Well, wonderful, wonderful conversation.
Okay,
there.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. As always, Bob Mankoff, cartoon editor of The New Yorker. His memoir is called How About Never Is Never Good For You. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, great recipes, wines, cocktails that we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you.